From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. In Iowa this week, wall to bleachers coverage of caucusers caucusing and of an emergent insurgent, GOP runner-up Rick Santorum. It was as if the media were supercharged with ethanol.
I can only say three letters, OMG. Look at this. Look what's going on. One vote right now.
As it stands right now, too close to call, and it's just unbelievable when you look at the numbers.
It's still too close to call, and we do not have any idea when we're going to be able to call this. It's great.
But we're not going to cover the Iowa caucuses because they totally didn't matter. What does matter this week and always about the political process is where the money comes from to fund campaigns and how that money is spent. State and federal election commissions collect fairly good data on the contribution side, but the spending side is mainly mysterious. That's largely because the recipients of the cash, chiefly local TV stations, have very limited obligations for making the information public. Till now, they've merely had to keep a public file of political ad sales and submit that file for review to any member of the public who physically walks into a station to request it. A proposed Federal Communications Commission regulation would require stations to routinely digitize the data so that the FCC could make it readily and rapidly available online. But the broadcasting industry is resisting. Stephen Waldman, now visiting senior media policy scholar at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, was the author of the FCC report which led to the proposed regulation. He says the FCC's media policy was written before the internet and should be updated for the digital age.
You can take this material and put it online, and in doing that, make it much more useful because people from other towns can see it. You can take information from five different stations and aggregate it easily and see really what the patterns are in a community or across a region. It really takes this gold mine of really useful information and makes it much more effective as a transparency tool.
I just want to make this clear. Stations already collect the information and are required to keep track of who's paying what for what.
Yes, exactly. It's on pieces of paper in a filing cabinet in their offices. The way the files are currently kept is they have to update them pretty frequently, really within 48 hours. The rules apply not only to federal races, but also state races, local races, the mayor. So instead of having this situation where after the election's over, you find out all sorts of useful, interesting information about how campaign money was spent, the TV stations are keeping this in real time.
The minimum requirement for maintaining a broadcast license is so much less onerous than it has been historically. There's not a whole lot that broadcasters have to do in exchange for that free access to the broadcast spectrum that they control.
In the olden days, there was this basic pact that broadcasters would get the spectrum for free from taxpayers, and in exchange they would do certain service to the community. And originally, there was fairly specific prescriptive rules about amounts of public affairs programming and things like that. Over time, for a variety of reasons, that faded away. And now their main responsibility is to keep track of certain types of information in what they call the public inspection file. And so partly what this FCC rule is doing is saying it would be nice now if we allowed the public to inspect the public inspection file, make it easier so that this transparency obligation could become more meaningful, because right now it's really not all that meaningful.
The NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, has said that this change in the rules will create a greater data collection burden and an onerous one.
If that's true, they will become the first industry that I've heard of that managed to use the internet to become less efficient and more costly. So maybe if they're not thinking about it the right way, yeah, you can always duplicate effort, but it's basic transparency 101 for the information age. The FCC, in fact, took, you know, a fairly light-touch approach on this and focusing on transparency, frankly. The Citizens United case— which has led to this increase in spending, including a windfall for local TV stations. Justice Kennedy, when he wrote that, said, the reason that we don't need caps and limits is we have such great disclosure. So
this is the other shoe that has to drop, according to the majority opinion in the Citizens United case, to make Citizens United make sense in a democracy, that the disclosure of where the money is coming from gives the public better context and understanding as to who's got a dog in each fight.
Exactly. Say what you will about the Citizens United decision and what possibly negative effects it's had on the political system. There's clearly one big winner in that, and it's local TV stations. Local TV stations are earning a lot of money from political ads as a result of the looser campaign rules. And so it seems reasonable that hand in hand with that would go some sort of obligation to help the population police how this money is being spent.
Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Stephen Waldman is visiting senior media policy scholar at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. Jack Goodman is a legal counsel to the National Association of Broadcasters. He says their proposal would put an onerous burden on stations because the digital submission of the advertising files is not nearly as efficient as Waldman describes.
You're assuming that there would be a spreadsheet, which would be an entirely different form of record keeping. Right now, there are a variety of types of records that go into a station's political file. There are initial inquiries from candidates and their managers about the availabilities of time. That can come in by email, that can come in by fax, that can come in by telephone call. Then the commission requires that the station keep records of how it disposed of those requests, which can often mean multiple offers and counteroffers. Say, candidate says, I want 200 spots. Station says, how about 60? And they negotiate to 110. All those negotiations have to be reflected in the file. Then there is a contract. Then the file must indicate when the spots aired and how much were paid for them.
Let's just say that you're right and that the paperwork burden for member stations would increase, not diminish. Broadcasters who use public airwaves are asked very little in exchange for their licenses. Even if it were an onerous burden, is that not sort of like a minimum responsibility for stations to meet their public disclosure requirements?
I have to say that the assumptions in that question are highly debatable. The whole question of whether the airwaves belong to the public is one that has been debated for 80 years, and the assumption that there is one answer is not at all clear. But even assuming it is, broadcasters do a lot. In particular, in this case, they are required to give reasonable access to candidates for federal elective office. They generally give access to others, and they have to provide that at a substantial discount to normal commercial rates.
Now, you describe that as a sacrifice. It may be a sacrifice of a sort, but it's one that provides billions of dollars of cash into the coffers of TV stations.
Indeed, stations do sell a lot of time, but they do sell it at a discount from what they otherwise would be able to sell it at. So the broadcasters do give a lot. And the question is, what is the purpose of putting all this material online? Because the people who primarily use it, who are the people in the community for whom the local public file was established, and candidates who need to find information about what their opponents are running, have access to that information.
The question is, the rest of the country's access, in order to find out what a station in Davenport, Iowa, is getting from the candidates for the Republican nomination or from super PACs, is limited to those who can, you know, drag their sorry butts into the TV stations themselves and ask to see a paper file. Obviously, there are benefits of transparency that go far beyond the physical borders of Davenport. Do you see no advantage to the body politic as a whole having access to what's being spent community by community?
Well, for example, if you wanted to have a post-election report where you said, how much money did the Romney campaign spend on this particular station in Manchester during the New Hampshire primary, that would be a very different question and would present a lot of different issues than the proposal the commission has made, which is the file as it is uploaded on essentially a constant basis. The burden of doing this, which is very, very large, needs to be contrasted with the benefit. Who exactly would benefit from it?
it's probably fair to say that the notion of transparency in the campaign finance process has become a major societal imperative over recent decades, and that it's long ceased to be controversial that the public at large has an interest in knowing what political candidates are spending where.
And that information is available in a variety of ways. It's not only available in terms of the public file at television stations, it is also, of course, available at the Federal Election Commission.
You get to find out what they've collected at the Federal Election
And what they spent,
but you don't know where. You don't know how it's been deployed. You don't know how it's been sliced and diced. I need hardly tell you that data is useful in many, many ways that may not be entirely obvious at first blush.
The negotiations back and forth over whether a candidate gets 100 spots or 150 spots is only really of interest to that candidate. Yet that would be required to be uploaded. And what broadcasters suggested is that before the commission adopts a rule, it should establish a working group to develop a system that's workable, that's scalable, and that is not burdensome and provides the information that people think is required.
So in general, you're down with this information being widely available in real time, provided you can come up with a mechanism for so doing that doesn't require scanning hundreds of documents and manually feeding them onto the internet.
I think it is worth considering. I don't want to say that I'm for it because, again, I'm not altogether sure what is the audience for this information, what exactly do they need, and when do they need it. And the commission didn't even address those issues.
All right. Jack, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Jack Goodman is a broadcast attorney and outside counsel to the National Association of Broadcasters. Coming up, the president signs a controversial new law that he says he won't enforce, and the Justice Department decides to stop enforcing an anachronistic old law it's been using improperly. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Okay, at the start of the show, I lied. We'll sort of cover Iowa now, but only to observe that the race there was not waged as much with TV attack ads as has been portrayed in the press. The 100,000 or so caucusers were not an anonymous mass reached remotely through the impersonal blue light of the boob tube. For the most part, they were known to the competing campaigns by name and by a whole lot of personally identifying information. Modern national politics is not only retail, it's online retail, based on all sorts of data individuals have left behind knowingly and otherwise. Michael Duhaime's job is precisely to crunch such data. He's a GOP strategist who served as the political director for the Republican National Committee and who led the Get Out the Vote organization for Bush Cheney in 2004. He says you'd be shocked if you knew what's happening with your personal information.
There are data warehouses in this country that basically just buy and sell information about your consumer history, and it's all publicly available, and it's all completely legal within privacy laws. There's census information about your neighborhood and what your income levels may be, your education levels may be, whether or not you own or rent your home, whether or not you have children in your home, what age group are your children. These things are important when you start thinking about things like education, for example. There are predictive models you can use. For example, you can look at somebody who drives a big red Chevy pickup truck versus somebody who maybe drives a hybrid or a Prius, and maybe you can extrapolate something. Somebody who drives a Prius, how they care about the environment. There might be something, if you get Field & Stream magazine, maybe you feel differently about the Second Amendment. There's all these different types of things. No one of them is any kind of magic bullet, but what these very smart data warehouse folks do is assign numerical values to all these different pieces of information. Then they overlay the political information on top of that from polling and other things. And they just essentially try to predict what issues you want to hear about.
There's much more granular data that campaigns can act upon, maybe because one way or another, I, as the intermittent or independent voter, has left my name or email address or something with someone connected to the campaign?
Sure. If you've ever gone to a campaign's website, most likely they've got your information, or at least your email address. Certainly, if you've ever donated money online, they're going to keep that information and continue to then ask for money. Broadcast television ads are still hugely important to campaigns. But if you go to their website and you check out where, for example, a candidate stands on tax policy, the next time you're on a site about monster trucks, you might see an ad for this candidate and their tax policies. What campaigns are doing now is in many ways mimicking what has been done very well in the private sector. And quite frankly, the campaigns now do it so well, the private sector is coming back around trying to learn from the campaigns.
For many, many years, I've observed the development of data mining in the commercial world. Something I see happen again and again and again is that marketers begin to forget that the data points are not just data points, but actual live human beings, you know, with DNA and opinions and moods and feelings. Is there not some, you know, grave risk that a huge political apparatus built around data will, you know, sort of completely lose the thread that, you know, we're talking about live human beings in voting booths?
One of the things that is done to try to take that into account is all this data is one thing, but there's often a lot of polling that goes into this as well and that is overlaid on top of this political data that tries to figure out how people are supporting but also how people are feeling. Campaigns and elections do not take place, you know, in some computer laboratory somewhere. This effort is to try to get a bit of an advantage to talk to people about the issues that they care about in a way that they would like to hear, but it is not some sort of panacea that is going to just automatically win you any election. Ultimately, it's going to come down to the candidates and the candidates' ability to connect with the voters.
There's one final thing I want to ask you, and it has to do with fundamental democracy. If it's true that super PACs and corporate voices and big money and the so-called special interests have a disproportionate voice in campaigns that, you know, perhaps drowns out others, is it data that will put the power back in the hands of the individual voter?
If there are people who are willing to use it and harness it, because it is much more efficient and ultimately much cheaper than grand television advertising, especially when you get into the bigger, more expensive media markets like New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, that are prohibitive in terms of how expensive they are for the average campaign or candidate. I do think this data will enable individuals and campaigns to have a greater impact, but much of this technology used on both sides is designed to motivate people to vote. We still have a large number of people in this country who don't vote, and as much as people may want to moan about the influence of outside special interests and others, their interests would be diluted if more people voted.
All right. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Michael Duhaime is Republican political strategist and managing director of Mercury Public Affairs. Last weekend, President Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act for 2012. The law authorizes $662 million in military spending and facilitates financial sanctions on Iran. But catching the most attention was a provision that appears to codify the military's capacity to indefinitely detain American citizens, even those captured on American soil. For a variety of reasons, coverage of the new law has been filled with exaggeration and contradiction, in part because the statute itself is intermittently vague and contradictory, but also because the president signed the bill into law while proclaiming his administration will not use its provisions to detain American citizens. The problem with that, as many an editorial has observed, is that nothing stops a future president from doing so, and we could have a different president in 13 months. University of Chicago law professor Jeff Stone says that the scope of the provision is muddied still further by ongoing uncertainty as to who constitutes an enemy, what constitutes the war on terror, and whether the new statute at all changes the status quo. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the most obvious question. If the president so worries about the implications of the detention provision, why did he sign the bill at all?
It's a large, complex bill that includes a great many provisions having absolutely nothing to do with these issues. And as is often the case with legislation, it's a take it or leave it deal.
The president offered us a signing statement. I think of it as an asterisk. What's the asterisk say?
Well, the asterisk is basically the president saying, I'm going to sign this bill, but I'm signing it on the understanding that I will enforce it in a particular way. In this instance, basically, the president said that he will enforce the statute in a way that will not allow the the detention of American citizens or individuals otherwise detained on American soil in the military system.
A New York Times editorial made the situation look like one step shy of the Gulag Archipelago, asserting that the president has been invested with broad new authority to detain Americans, and that Congress has taken away the administration's ability to spend money on typical criminal prosecutions when the suspect is a terrorist suspect. Is either of those assertions correct?
They're both pretty dramatically overstated. The statute as enacted made clear that nothing that is explicitly in these statutes changes existing law or authority. What is problematic is we don't know what the state of the law was before that. We do know, for example, that the Bush administration detained Jose Padilla, who was an American citizen, brought him into military custody and held him there, claiming that he had the authority to do that because he was working in cahoots with Al-Qaeda. But we've never had any determination whether that was lawful.
So let me see if I've got this right. In 2001, the Congress acted to give powers to then-President Bush to fight the war on terror, and he interpreted that law liberally. But there has been no jurisprudence to clarify the extent of executive and military power in these things. So all this new law says is, yeah, whatever we had before, we have now. And yet we don't even know what it is we have.
That's exactly right.
How do we create a body of law to reinforce our fundamental liberties and give the military and I guess the CIA the ability to lock up the bad guys?
Well, we have the same problem in this respect that we have in so many areas in Washington. That is, we have two competing visions of what good policy would be. One is that endorsed by the Republicans, who take a pretty Neanderthal, excuse the term, view of individual liberties in this context.
You can't say Neanderthal and then excuse yourself. Okay, you're either saying Neanderthal or you ain't.
Okay. The Republicans take a fairly Neanderthal view of individual liberties in this context, and what they would want to enact in this legislation is something that would be extremely repressive and would absolutely push the limits of anything that we would recognize as due process. And then you have the Democrats who take a more civil libertarian view on these issues, and the problem is that they can't find any common ground. Usually what happens is gridlock and nothing happens. What's happened here is because these provisions were part of a larger statute in which there were good reasons to pass the whole statute, they wind up putting in what amounts to gibberish.
So what has been accomplished is fundamentally nothing. But does that nothingness erode our civil liberties in the long run by virtue of the president having just participated in the charade?
It does, in the sense that the existence of the statute adds some weight to an understanding of what the law should be in favor of a more repressive interpretation of how we would deal with detention. So in that sense, I think it's fair to criticize the law and to criticize the president for signing it.
The very fact that the president has acknowledged that there's an extreme interpretation of the law which violates at least his understanding of basic civil liberties, doesn't that mean that that possibility applies to all subsequent presidents?
Subsequent presidents could choose to interpret the law differently from the way President Obama has interpreted it. And to the extent that signing the law leaves open those possibilities, it has a danger. On the other hand, the thing to remember is that even if the law had never been enacted, subsequent presidents could have done the same thing.
Jeff, as always, thank you very, very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jeffrey Stone is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Chicago. On December 24th, the U.S. Department of Justice delivered an astonishing Christmas gift to 44 states of the Union. A gift because it unleashes billions of dollars in revenue, and astonishing because it reverses a long-standing interpretation of a 50-year-old law. The Justice Department said it would no longer invoke the 1961 Federal Wire Act to forbid in-state internet gambling. freeing states to run their lotteries online and to issue tax revenue-producing licenses to online casinos. For many in the gaming industry, which is what the gambling industry calls itself, so it doesn't have to call itself the gambling industry, the move was long overdue. The Wire Act, after all, was enacted to outlaw a particular kind of bookmaking fraud. I. Nelson Rose, distinguished senior professor at Whittier Law School, says you probably know the illegal scam. It was the central premise of the movie The Sting.
Into the back stretch. It's Lucky Dan and Link. Got to twinkle half, barking ahead. I'm a dreamer by one, followed by...
Sorry, but you couldn't wait. Everything going all right?
Around the curve, you got nothing to worry about. Dr. Twinkle Link.
I put it all on Lucky Dan. $500,000 to win.
The Wire Act was designed to cut the wire, and the wire was a telegraph wire that let illegal bookies get the results of horse races before the bettors. And it wasn't even clear that it would apply to telephones, but then came the internet, and the Department of Justice was faced with trying to close down something it considered illegal without any laws on the books to do it.
What was the effect on the states?
It basically scared all the states into not legalizing most forms of internet gambling because they were afraid the federal government would come down and arrest them for organized crime violations under the Wire Act.
So now states are free to put their lotteries up online as long as they don't sell across state lines?
Well, the impact of this is going to be really big because not only does it mean the states can do intrastate internet selling of lottery tickets, there's now no federal law that says they can't do interstate or even international, with the exception of sports betting. And there is a challenge even to the separate federal statute that limits sports betting.
I want to ask you about another federal law that applies here, and that's from 2006. It explicitly banned the transfer of funds by banks and other financial institutions in service of online betting. Where did that come from, and where does that stand?
Well, it's the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act. It was rammed through by Bill Frist when the Republicans controlled both houses. He was the majority leader of the Senate, and President Bush signed it, and it was rushed through so fast it doesn't even have a good acronym. Nobody knows how to pronounce UIGEA.
Yeah, so WIGA was rammed through the Congress and signed by the president into law.
Right.
And didn't that shut down the online poker industry?
Yes, it scared all of the publicly traded companies like Party Gaming, which was running Party Poker, out of the U.S. market. It instantly wiped out $8 billion in equity.
Now, I ask you this question not as a journalist, but as the world's worst online poker player.
Yes.
Does this mean that I'm going to get my game back?
You are eventually going to get your game back.
All right, that's swell for me. I can now squander endless hours playing No Limit Hold'em with strangers from all around the world. But I'm curious about the state lottery side of this.
Yes.
You know, great, the states are now free to enter the online world with impunity. But state lotteries have always been problematic because they are essentially the world's most regressive tax. They are money that is lost by the most vulnerable people in great sums to fund some governmental good work. Is that problem not going to just be amplified, maybe exponentially, once gambling is legal online?
It's not the most regressive tax. State lottery is almost exactly as regressive as a sales tax, which means it does hit poor people more than wealthy, but it's actually not the very poor. It's the working poor who would be most hit by a state lottery. And the internet attracts people with slightly higher incomes. So internet sales will be less regressive if you view it as a tax than paper lottery ticket sales.
If you agree that to some degree it's a sort of Faustian bargain, the state getting the benefit of income from people who are substantially the working poor, does going online enable the state to regulate how much an individual can spend, for example, in a way that they can't regulate it for people standing in lines at liquor stores?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are actually better protections even against children playing because you can compare driver license database and other court records and property ownership and such. But for compulsive gambling, they have a lot more protections in place and a lot easier to send messages saying, hey, here's some place where you can get help. Of course, the problem is if players want to do this, they could go to another site. The good thing about this is that most people are going to want to play on those state licensed sites because they know they'll be honest and they'll get paid if they win.
Nelson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I, Nelson Rose, is a professor of law at Whittier Law School. His website is gamblingandthelaw.com. Coming up, two ways to augment the viewing experience. Here's one of them. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school. At wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. There was the old way to shoot a sitcom, and then there's the modern way. The old way was with multiple cameras shooting from fixed angles, usually before a live studio audience, an audience whose reaction was heavily augmented by a laugh track to signal to viewers at home where the hilarity was located. Other shows, notably Hogan's Heroes, were with no audience and 100% canned laughter. The modern technique is the one-camera shoot, a la Modern Family, with no live audience and no laugh track. Viewers, like a movie audience, have to locate and react to the jokes all by themselves. The unadorned one-camera technique is becoming so common, in fact, that it would be tempting to prepare an obituary for the laugh track. But Joe Adalian, who writes about Hollywood for New York Magazine, says, not so fast. Joe, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, sir.
Who does a sitcom these days without electronic enhancement?
Most really big sitcoms these days come without laugh tracks, unless they're on CBS. CBS has remained the stalwart for traditional shows, but even those shows, by the way, are not, according to the creators, electronically augmented. Most of the comedies on CBS have a studio audience in them, Two and a Half Men, Two Broke Girls, The Big Bang Theory. Their creators all insist, we don't do anything, we don't sweeten it, etc. The only show on CBS that actually cops to using a laugh track, believe it or not, is How I Met Your Mother. Even though it's shot in a single camera style, laughs are added in after the fact, which is pretty amazing because if you listen to How I Met Your Mother, it's actually a very subtle laugh track.
And what made you decide you wanted to become an architect?
Well, you know, soul of an artist, hands of a master craftsman. It was inevitable, I guess.
The laughs on How I Met Your Mother are probably a lot more mellow than the ones you might get on Two and a Half Men.
$80 million.
Yeah, give or take, mostly Tuck.
And you consider losing that kind of money and oops?
Yeah.
No. Oops is when you clip your toenails too close and they bleed. Oops is when you mistake toothpaste for lubricant. Oops is when you thought a fart in the elevator was going to be silent.
In your piece, you talk about how the laugh audio can be manipulated without actually being faked altogether. Sort of accentuate reality without, strictly speaking, changing it.
We wondered when you have creators saying we don't manipulate the laughs, and yet to our ears at least they sound fake, what could be going on? And some sound engineers say that, well, yes, you can just use the audio track that's supplied by the audience, but depending upon how it's laid in, depending upon where you position the microphone, what levels capture, for example, the actors on stage versus the audience in the studio, all of that can make the sound of laughter seem louder than it naturally is. Whether or not these shows do it or not, you know, only their hairdressers know for sure. And there is this sense of quiet shame about this. Nobody really wants to talk about it because, of course, it implies that the show's not funny.
But there are certainly shows that are indisputably fully natural, right?
You can talk to the people who work in sound in Hollywood, and they will tell you about different audiences for shows. And going back to, say, for example, Married with Children in the 80s, that show used to get loyal audiences coming in every week for the tapings. Oftentimes, a bunch of Marines would come by with their entire platoons. Those people genuinely laughed at everything Al Bundy said, did.
Look here, Miranda. If you really want some film at 11, why don't you follow me down to the brewery? I'll tie a bowling ball to my ankle, dive in the vat of beer. I'll leave this world the same way I entered my marriage, dead drunk.
There was no reason to electronically supplement them or make them bigger because they were huge. And I bet the same is true with 2 and a Half Men.
So where did these laugh tracks come from? There's always been studio audiences to have available. Have they not always been a part of sitcom production?
Yes and no. Early TV shows were, of course, filmed in front of studio audiences with actual people actually laughing. But the people who did the shows started realizing that because they sometimes would have 2 and 3 and 4 takes of a scene, the laughs for number 2 and 3 and 4 weren't perhaps as robust. And sometimes, because this was older technology, not the digital wonders that we have today, maybe the microphone wouldn't pick up a laugh the way that the producer wanted, or there could be something that went wrong in the editing. The man named Charlie Douglas saw an opportunity there, and he basically created a machine able to record on loop tape different sounds of laughter from live studio audiences.
Are you trying to run down a listless? Do you pop out at parties?
One of the earliest laughs he recorded was Lucille Ball's mother actually laughing and making an out loud comment at one of her daughter's shows. Soon, producers all over Hollywood realized there was this guy who could make your laugh sound much, much better. And so, as with anything in Hollywood, what started out as a natural idea with a very pure motive of making sure everything was even and level and consistent started getting abused a little bit. And suddenly people thought, well, maybe the show's not that funny, but, you know, Mr. Laughman will like it.
In the meantime, studio audiences and laugh box supplements kind of coexisted until at some point, at maybe the nadir of sitcom culture and maybe the nadir of human culture, Gilligan's Island came along and other shows that were entirely the creation of laugh boxing, huh?
What basically happened was studios also started experimenting with single camera shows. They ditched the studio audience altogether. They tried to make shows look a little bit different, involve more outdoor scenes and different production techniques. And suddenly you didn't have a studio audience showing up to watch The Brady Bunch or Gilligan's Island.
I want you to go outside, and I don't want you to come back in until you've counted 10.
But it's dark out there. Can I count to 10 by fives?
No, Gilligan.
Fours?
No, by ones. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
I can count faster than that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Gilligan, outside.
It was simply at the whim of, say, a Sherwood Schwartz, simply add the laughs as often as he wanted to, and that's why, in fact, they sounded so incredibly artificial. What also happened was Mr. Douglas didn't, at least in the early days, do a good job updating his laughs. In the late 1960s, watching Gilligan's Island, you might be hearing an audience from the 50s laughing at the day's jokes. Some people who had good ears could actually pick up, wait a second, I know that lady's laugh. And the joke became, as laugh technicians will tell you today, that there were probably a few dead people laughing at jokes in some of the shows in the 60s and 70s.
Now, we're talking about Gilligan's Island, which was on a set that went beyond the routine sitcom interior. Another show that did that was MASH, which it surprised me to learn also was laugh-tracked, against the creator's wishes, as it turns out.
Especially in the 70s, a lot of network types simply thought that if you didn't have the sound of people laughing, nobody would laugh. And even though Larry Gelbart thought, well, what about movies? Network people didn't care, and they insisted on it. And it is a shame because sometimes you watch those episodes of MASH and think, why do I have to hear these annoying laughs?
I'll carry your books, I'll carry a torch, I'll carry a tune. I'll carry on, carry over, carry forward, carry Grant, cash and carry, carry me back to old Virginia. I'll even Harry carry if you show me how, but I will not carry a gun.
That was totally uncalled for.
Notwithstanding what I'm sure were titanic battles between Larry Gelbart and CBS over the question of whether to laugh track MASH and other arguments in control rooms about whether to ride the laugh track higher or lower and so forth, the assumption always was that it worked. But what if they actually don't matter? that it's not just me, but the fact that these modern shows don't use them is evidence that we never really paid much attention to the fake laughter to begin with.
What it can do is it changes the feel of a show. A show like Two Broke Girls, for example, which is very big and broad and theatrical, it plays off having a studio audience there. The actors are actually living off of the reaction they get from that audience to their laughs. They are punching it up. They're making it bigger.
Oh my God, you've been robbed. This is how it always looks. Oh my God, totally cute.
And that works and creates a different kind of show, as opposed to Modern Family, which its creator, Steve Levitan, who has sort of worked with both kinds of shows, says he loves single camera for the exact opposite reasons. His actors are not trying to milk every last laugh out of a line. They can allow a joke to sort of sit there and marinate and roll over you and sort of subtly get you. And it creates a different kind of feeling. So I guess it's maybe the difference between going to an Adam Sandler movie and a Woody Allen movie. I think in the end, I think there's room for both.
Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joe Adalian wrote about laugh tracks for New York Magazine. Now, what if rather than having a TV network add canned laughter to your program, you yourself could choose to add an additional layer of ruthless, funny commentary to a movie you're watching at home? This week, New York Times tech columnist David Pogue reminded us of a website that offers precisely such a service. Riff Tracks is the creation of three guys who have made a career of ridiculing bad movies in real time, originally on TV and now on the web through audio commentary you download and sync to the movie you're watching. You may recognize Kevin Murphy and Bill Corbett as the voices of Tom Servo and Crow, the robot companions of human frontman Mike Nelson on the trio's original TV series, Mystery Science Theater 3000. Kevin and Bill, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bob. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Hi, Bob.
Listen, before we get to talking about Riff Tracks, I apologize. You know, I'm sure Jimmy Buffett doesn't like to sing Margaritaville over and over and over and over, but, you know, he does. And I have to ask you to explain for the untutored exactly what Mystery Science Theater 3000 was. Go.
Well, Mystery Science Theater was in part a puppet show and in part a science fiction adventure show, but mostly it was an opportunity for a bunch of us to get together and make fun of cheesy old movies. What people remember from the show is a row of theater seats on your TV screen and an awful movie playing and three creatures sitting there watching that movie, throwing all sorts of comments at the film. That silhouette was the thing that people remember about it. And the riffing, when we would make commentary over the movie, is what people sort of carried forward from there.
And that riffing sounded approximately like this.
You know, in their silliest moments, the Three Stooges never reached this level of indignity.
You know, a lot of people have compared the scene to the climactic chariot scene in Ben-Hur.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, they usually say, Ben-Hur was really good. This movie totally sucks.
Yes, right. Follows.
But that show no longer exists.
Yeah, we had been on Comedy Central for 7 years, did very well. They decided to change their whole programming philosophy and go with obscene color forms, and now that's what South Park is. And then we went to the Sci-Fi Channel, and the Sci-Fi Channel also decided that they wanted to veer away from things that were funny. So there we went.
Okay, but wasn't there another production issue of there being a limited number of cheesy movies for you to make fun of? It's a little more expensive to get the rights to Dances with Wolves than some obscure Japanese space alien movie from 1964.
Yeah, well, there was never a shortage of bad movies and never will be, God willing. But the challenge at Mystery Science Theater was always that we had to make some sort of arrangement for rights and for things like Dances with Wolves, to use your example, or Titanic. We just couldn't get our hands on them. But now with Riff Tracks, we sort of solved that problem by recording our commentary as a separate track, and then people can kind of roll it together.
Jack, this is where we first met.
It was a lot more horizontal then, though.
I press you into my cheek, madam. I press you into my cheek.
All right, Bill, how does this work? What's the user experience?
The user experience is to rent the movie via one of the places you can do that, Netflix, and then separately, you download our commentary as an MP3.
At a very affordable price, I'm
What is the very attractive, affordable, easy-to-grip price?
For the commentaries, anywhere from 99 cents to $3.99 tops.
Okay, so I rented the movie and downloaded your commentary. And I sync that up somehow on my computer or my TV?
We've actually made it very easy. You can have either an iPad or a boombox or something that you can hear the riff through, and we also have the movie that's there on your TV screen. So we give you instructions on how to start and when to start. Say, Lord of the Rings, when the New Line logo fades out, we tell you to start the podcast.
The ring was made in the fires of Mount Doom. Only there can it be unmade. One of you must do this.
Oh, boy. I got to go.
Look at the time there. We also have a very helpful robotic voice that we call Disembodio, who reads a line of dialogue occasionally while you're watching the film so that you can make sure that you are in sync with the movie. And then if it isn't, you can pause one or the other just for usually a moment or two.
The other thing we've recently developed, though, is a RiffTrax player to be played on the computer.
So if this is too hard for the technologically disinclined Bob.
Like me.
Then you can actually just get your rented movie and your RiffTrax commentary track and put them in the RiffTrax player, and it works surprisingly well.
Yeah.
All right. Now, here's a scene from X-Men that has been RiffTraxed.
I know what you are.
You lost your money. You keep this up, you lose something else.
Like your keys or that little plastic thing that keeps the bread bag closed.
Look out!
So he has retractable metal claws that punch through his flesh, just like a real Wolverine.
Right. Just like a real Wolverine.
I want to ask you about the rights issue, okay? No, you don't actually take possession of a Hollywood film. You're just selling the riff track. Have you not gotten any kind of cease and desist correspondence from the studios or the distributors saying, integral to your comedy is our intellectual property and you're selling them as part of a kit?
I don't even know if we register on their gigantic radar, for one thing.
Number one.
The second thing is, if anybody ever did get a bit of a snit over it, I'm guessing they went to a lawyer and the lawyer just said, no, there's nothing we can do here.
We're not actually using their material. We're encouraging people to actually go out and buy or rent their material and then augment it with our riff tracks. Believe me, there are a lot of teenage boys who would not have watched any of the Twilight movies if it weren't for riff tracks. That's true.
You had your way with the Twilight movies?
and have we?
We ravished it thusly.
Yes, indeed.
And this will be a good thing.
Like Hot Topic.
I think.
But what do I know? I'm just your typically abnormally confident, world-weary 16-year-old female protagonist.
I didn't raise the issue of intellectual property for no reason. I have come to be aware of an organization that has absolutely taken wholesale your silhouettes riffing concept and is applying it to political advertising in something that they equally unashamedly call Media Scrutiny Theater 3000.
Wow.
Total coincidence, I'm sure.
Wow. Yeah. Well, anyway, it's us. It's on the media. It's doing this.
Well, thanks for telling us. I'll get the lawyers on the phone right now. I'm going to conference
Draw
him
off
in.
The papers.
Instead of litigating the question, you could just give us some pointers. What is the secret for playing off of what's on the screen without getting in the way?
Don't think that every line is a setup line for a joke. Just find the ones that are the best ones, the best setup lines for the joke.
My first advice is get a puppet.
Getting a puppet is good.
Yeah.
Puppets help. It's true.
For this and in general.
I don't have one, but Brooke has, you know, me.
There you go.
Kevin Murphy, Bill Corbett, thank you very much.
Our pleasure, Bob.
Thanks, Bob. It was great.
Kevin Murphy and Bill Corbett with Mike Nelson are the voices of RiffTrax. By the way, in a few weeks, OTM is indeed relaunching Media Scrutiny Theater 3000, in which Brooke and Bob's silhouettes dish on the latest political ads. If you want to see the previous batch, just go to our website, onthemedia.org. Here's a clip where we were riffing over an ad from Republican Rick Barber.
You gentlemen revolted over
this guy is inciting armed
a
rebellion.
Don't be silly. It's not as though he's gathering an army.
gather your armies.
Do you have the number for the FBI? That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Lina Anwar and Hannah Sheehan. Our senior producer is Katya Rogers, and our show was edited this week by Katya and me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was John Delore. Ellen Horn is WNYC's Senior Director of National Programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.